Food as a weapon of war. One final area of research, which is extremely pertinent to the conversation around what might be termed big food, is the history of food being used as a weapon during times of war. Throughout modern and ancient history, we have examples of warring nations using food as a way to destroy their enemy or empower their allies. Providing or withholding food during conflict is equally as powerful as guns, drones, and missiles. Controlling an opponent's access to food is important during war and can also be a bargaining tactic. Sometimes food is used as a weapon by destroying the harvest or preventing a harvest from being shipped to other locations. The phrase, salting the earth, was born out of the ritual of spreading salt in the soil of a conquered land in an effort to prevent crops from growing again. The U.S. has historically used food as a tool of foreign policy, delivering aid to nations which follow programs favored by the U.S. and its allies, and initiating embargoes and tariffs on food goods for nations which do not comply. In recent years, there have also been discussions on using food to blackmail nations into adopting population control programs.
The United States, through the Agency for International Development, has provided rapidly increasing support for population and family planning programs throughout the developing world.
This might sound like insanity, but a 1974 memo drafted by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger outlines the entire plan. The memo is called National Security Study Memorandum 200, Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests, and was drafted by Kissinger for the United States National Security Council. The memo focuses on the paramount importance to population control measures and the promotion of contraceptive measures to 13 populous nations known as the least developing countries. The argument was that the socio-political and economic growth of these countries is vital to national interests of the U.S. since the U.S. economy will require large and increasing amounts of minerals from abroad, and the countries can produce destabilizing opposition forces against the U.S. The Kissinger Report discusses how there already existed a precedent for, quote, taking account of family planning performance and appraisal of assistance requirements by U.S. aid. The report goes on to state that allocation of scarce resources should, quote, take account of what steps a country is taking in population control as well as food production. The document also notes that it is important to, quote, avoid the appearance of coercion while also discussing mandatory programs. The document also considers whether or not food can be considered, quote, an instrument of national power. The document states, is the U.S. prepared to accept food rationing to help people who can't or won't control their population growth? Of course, it should be noted that Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, is a longtime associate of the Rockefeller Agenda. Our conversation started with the Rockefeller-driven Green Revolution and the Gene Revolution, and now we come full circle with the Rockefeller's latest initiative, Reset the Table. The Rockefeller Foundation is now claiming that COVID-19 and the economic losses from lockdowns have, quote, made the negative consequences of the food system worse and more obvious. The foundation notes that COVID-19 has presented the moment to transform the U.S. food system. The Rockefeller document, titled Reset the Table, Meeting the Moment to Transform the U.S. Food System, outlines how the Rockefeller Foundation can once again use its money and influence to shape the direction of a major industry, this time the food supply itself. Ironically, the Reset the Table document also notes that the Rockefeller Foundation played a role in seeding and scaling the Green Revolution, while also noting that the Rockefeller Green Revolution left a legacy of, quote, overemphasis of staple grains at the expense of more nutrient-rich foods, and a, quote, reliance on chemical fertilizers that deplete the soil and overuse of water. With no hint of shame, the Rockefellers and their ilk will present themselves as the solution to problems they have previously contributed to or outright created, using the same flowery language and trendy buzzwords which allowed them to infiltrate and capture the education system, the oil industry, and the medical field. They have managed to gain control over the large institutions which farm the world's animals and crops in violent, destructive, and costly ways. this dangerous monopolistic cartel has captured many national and international regulatory bodies designed to protect the public and the food supply. The players involved in this piece of the pyramid of power also continue to use their wealth and connections to suppress research, which paints their products and investments in a negative light, including GMOs and pesticides. Finally, these criminal elements have made it clear that they believe food can be, and indeed should be, used as a tool for negotiation or a tool for forcing compliance from populations.
Well, good morning, CHD. This is a very, very important conversation. It's Friday, 29th of July, 2022, and we've got to have this conversation. So many of you writing in, telling us what is going on around the world with the food supply and your fears and worries. So we brought the very best of the best, an expert in this subject, who made that documentary that you just watched a part of, Derek Brose. He is co-founder of the Freedom Cell Network and the Greater Reset. Welcome, welcome, Derek Brose, to the program this morning.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we do as well. Now, listen, let's start. Let's get straight into it, because we've only got a certain amount of time, and I know our viewers are excited to talk about this subject. Food as a weapon of war, it's got to be the most powerful thing, more than drones, as you say in your article, more than any other weapon. It has to be food.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, so as you said, that clip we just played there is part of a larger documentary that is all about food as a weapon of war, food as a weapon in general. And that one section focuses on the history, as I mentioned, that historically, you know, you can go back thousands of years and find accounts of one tribe fighting the other, and when one tribe wins, they would come in and literally pour salt on or burn all the crops and you know, destroy things. And that, it wasn't just out of pure instinct to destroy, it was done to hurt, you know, any survivors, hurt the enemy, make it difficult for people to survive into the next harvest and the next. We've seen some of those same tactics, I think, including, as I referenced there, the memorandum written by Henry Kissinger, and even up to the time where we're at today with the Ukraine-Russia situation, and you know, there's a lot of talk about the wheat. I think there are some pretty good evidence and writing and research out there showing that actually is a bigger factor than many people might be realizing as far as the purposes of this particular conflict. And, you know, even outside of talking about war, like people think about drones and bombs and, you know, conflicts and those sense, the average person might not think about themselves as being a part of a war. But if you are, let's say, facing daily rising food prices, if you're having difficulty finding nutrient-dense food, if you're maybe in an area where you can't find, you know, organic, pesticide-free food, and you start to recognize, as many of us have, that this didn't just happen by accident. As I mentioned in there, you can go back generations to the Green Revolution in the 70s with the Rockefellers, and then more recent situations and power players. And you can see that this has been done by design. And so it's all, I mean, whether people recognize it or not, I would say that those things I mentioned, GMO foods, pesticides, lack of nutrients, depletion of the soil, you know, might as well be acts of war on the people, whether we recognize them that way or not.
What can you talk to us a bit about the Rockefeller Green and Gene Revolution? What is that?
Yeah, so in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller family, they partnered with this scientist named Norman Borlaug, and he was a plant geneticist, and they actually brought him down to Mexico, where I live now, and he spent time coming to indigenous farms where people have been growing food and corn and all kinds of crops just fine for thousands of years, and basically came down here and said, you guys are doing it all wrong. You don't know how, you know, what you're doing. Let us help you. And so they started practicing on some of the rural indigenous Mexican farmers, bringing pesticides and then trying to introduce things like the Gene Revolution, pertains more to genetically modified, genetically engineered foods. And so they tried to bring in both those things, bring in monocropping, these mass kind of factory farming, the farming that most people know of in the modern world, the sort of the thing that we consider to be normal. They started to bring a lot of those practices in here. Whereas prior to the Rockefellers coming in here, and there's somewhat of a revival of this happening now, but prior to the Rockefellers coming in here, Mexican farmers have been growing food for thousands of years in traditional ways, different indigenous groups, tribes that are, that still exist and still are here in Mexico, some of which who've held on to their traditional growing methods, including what's known as a milpa, just a way to grow the corn, for example, and different ways to set up your food. These things were sort of seen as, by the Rockefellers at least, and promoted as, that's the way your grandmas used to do things. That's old. That's, you know, we need to modernize and bring it up, and it'll make you all the promises of the green and gene revolution, which never were fulfilled, which were that with genetically engineered rice, we're going to feed the world. With pesticides, the whole world, you know, we're going to end hunger. We're going to end all these things. And sure, you know, we saw mass production of food because of these policies, but by no means have they ended hunger, you know, helped the poor African farmers or any of these things, the Indian farmers and the different things that we were told. And in fact, I'm sure many of the viewers are familiar with some of the research and the reports around the results of this. And you end up with things like the Indian farmers who end up becoming indebted because they use a GMO seed, and then now they owe Monsanto or whoever that company. And then there's been a huge spike in the last decades of Indian farmer suicides, people drinking the glyphosate, drinking the poison to kill themselves because they were just so distraught, they were stuck in debt, right? And so we can see that the promises of this so-called green revolution and gene revolution, they really don't hold up once you actually start looking into them. But that's generally the sort of like storybook Disney version of history that we're told, is the Green Revolution came along and it led to all these modern growing techniques and mass production of food, and the Gene Revolution came along and it helped us with GMO. You know, it doesn't really hold up when you actually look at the science and you look at the record. I think you're muted, Polly.
Yeah, well, you know, I should know better. I do enough show. Let's bring it back to today's world. The biggest problem I think we have in this day and age is the World Economic Forum, whichever way you want to talk about it, but they're reset the table, whatever. And people aren't talking about that. They're talking about all, you know, the other things that these people are doing. But this is something really serious. We're seeing production facilities being burnt down all over the world. Really odd, weird weather manipulation for sure going on. I don't care how crazy that sounds. We know these things are happening. What are we looking at with the World Economic Forum, and who made them king of the jungle?
So yeah, like you said, the World Economic Forum has definitely become the power player. I don't know if we can say they're the top of the pyramid. That's what my documentary is attempting to answer. You know, who really is at the top of this pyramid of power? But they're up there, and they clearly represent a lot of old power. So, for example, I was mentioning Henry Kissinger a moment ago, former Secretary of State, also a wanted war criminal in some parts of the world for his actions that he's taken over the years, bombing campaigns, etc. Well, Henry Kissinger was the mentor of Klaus Schwab, who is the current founder of the world, you know, the director of the World Economic Forum. So if that gives you kind of any insight into the company he keeps, it should tell you something, right? And so these people, unelected power, they call themselves the International Organization for Public-Private Cooperation, for public-private partnerships. And this is a term that has been really bandied about, including things like stakeholders, public-private partnerships, to the average person, and I think this is an important part of the conversation, especially if those of you who are hearing this, and you kind of, maybe you're familiar with this information, but you got friends and family who wouldn't be willing to go down these roads with you. And they might think, you know what, you sound crazy. I'm sorry, this is a conspiracy theory, what have you. It's important to get people to understand that the language that these institutions are using, and I'll include the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, many of these global organizations, they, I don't want to call them liars, but I would say that they are facetious in the language that they use. That when they talk about sustainability, inclusivity, diversity, equality, these kinds of things, and they use that language, those buzzwords or that flowery language, which appeals to our emotional sense and our compassion, you know, who wouldn't think those ideas sound good? It's important to look beyond just the buzzwords that they use and actually look at what they're describing. And when you get into the mechanics of what Klaus Schwab has called the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and you get into the mechanics of what they call the Great Reset, and now this Reset the Table initiative, what they are talking about is a top-down, centralized management of society by the stakeholders, the technocrats. And that's what they consider to be a public-private partnership, where you end up where corporate stakeholders and even people who are just CEOs, philanthropists, as we're told, not elected, never been voted on, end up having just as much power, if not more power, than people in government that you know, whether you believe your vote matters or not, the idea, at least in theory, is that those are your representatives and that, you know, you can vote to get rid of them. But in this case, with the public-private partnership, there's none of that recourse. There's no accountability. And what we're seeing with the people like the Schwabs and the Gateses of the world and the Soros and some of these other power players who, again, never been elected but are using their money, their influence, and their organizations and institutions to influence the world, that's the dream of the World Economic Forum, this public-private partnership, this technocratic rule. And absolutely a big part of this component is the food supply, because as I was saying a few moments ago and as we showed in the clip, the food supply can be used as a way to control people, to manipulate people, to coerce people. You don't necessarily need to have a gun to your head, as maybe the fascists kind of would rule in the past, where it's literally like, hey, do what we say or, you know, you're going to die. Maybe you find softer, more subtle, and, you know, more difficult ways to kind of fight back. You find ways to attack people that are, you know, more difficult to see. Inflation, rising food prices, potential food shortages, all those concerns, right? Those, I think, we should recognize as attacks on us, right? For example, during COVID times, many people were rising up and protesting and marching, and I think rightfully so. But that was largely driven because people could feel the consequences. They couldn't go to work. They couldn't travel. They were locked in their homes or, the, you know, quarantine, all the different stuff we were having to deal with. That's in your face. There's no way to avoid that, right? But right now, you're not locked down. You can go to work. You can go out. You just feel it when you go to the grocery store and the prices are a little high, or you can't find certain things, or, you know, you're, like I said, difficulty for some people accessing even good organic food. That's still an attack, as far as I'm concerned, on our well-being and on our future and on our health. And obviously, we know the importance of mental, physical health, spiritual health, how that plays into, you know, just overall health and the future of humanity. So I think that the World Economic Forum, and it's clear the Rockefeller Foundations and some of these organizations that are have really been around for quite some time are just continuing the same trend that they have been doing for years. You know, I don't think the Green Revolution was about helping people. I think it was about gaining more control of the food supply and integrating these concepts that they knew would lead to cancers and making people sick and weakening the nutrition that we have access to. And this Great Reset, and as well as the Reset the Table initiative, to me, it's just one more step in the direction they've been moving in for a long time.
All right. And now listen, some people say, oh, but Polly, the World Economic Forum is wonderful. They're helping people that are starving. Let's put out this article now. What is an innovation hub? And we don't want your food, World Economic Forum, because we know it's going to be bugs with stuff like that. And by the way, Sage Vegan, I do hope you're on here today, because he's a vegan. So you should be proud of me. I brought a vegan on for you. All right. Let's talk about these innovation hubs.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can get into the veganism aspect of it too, because like I mentioned to you before, like it's interesting, the vegan and this whole food issue. But the article that you guys were just showing, it's coming from the World Economic website. And I was doing some research recently, World Economic Forum website. They announced this, I think it was just at their most recent meeting, what they're calling food innovation hubs. And, you know, knowing everything that I just said, and if you understand the agendas of these people, I don't think this is a good thing. You know, again, if you're just reading this and you have no idea about anything, wow, 2 billion people are without food access. Current food systems need to produce more food. The World Economic Forum is going to bring together public, private, civil society partners to create local driven programs. You know, they can say all the right buzzwords, but as we know, you've got to judge people by their actions, by the fruit that, you know, and the things that they actually do. You know, you can write something nice on paper and claim to be this thing or that thing, but in reality, when you come in, if the food systems do not benefit, then, you know, we have to question what's really going on here. And I saw a comment a moment ago, food colonialism. This is colonization of the food supply. Absolutely. This is what is continuing to take place. And so they're using the same thing: sustainable, efficient, inclusive, diverse. We're going to deliver nutritious and healthy food. And honestly, you know, part of me wants to say, okay, maybe we'll give them a chance. Let's wait and see. Maybe the World Economic Forum really will come through and help out some people, because these sound like things that I could get behind. Cultivate new food system innovation, support and deliver these innovations at scale, develop community of practice to share learnings, things like that, right? These are things that I feel like many of us here are trying to do and are concerned about, but I don't think this is going to bear positive fruit for the average person. What I would think is that these food innovation hubs, much like we know people are familiar with the Young Global Leaders Program, how people like Trudeau and many of other leaders have gone through the World Economic Forum, have basically been trained up by them and then sent out to go to politics or corporations. you know, those programs don't end up good for the people. I wouldn't assume that this Food Innovation Hub is going to end up in a positive format. We haven't seen what they're going to do with it yet. They've only announced it. But I will say, when you go down to the bottom of that page, there's a section that says Global Structure of Food Innovation Hubs, which to me makes it clear, again, that their goal is a global government. Now, maybe if we lived in a different world with where the top two nations, the U.S. and China, didn't have records of human rights abuses and torture and being, you know, just kind of authoritarians, maybe we could come together as a one world government and create a better world. But with the people in charge at the moment and the institutions like the World Economic Forum, I don't see how that ends up benefiting the average person like you or I or anybody listening here, right? So it's important to recognize that. But they are talking about this Food Innovation Hubs is going to be a global thing. This is going to support the adoption and innovation to create a global network. And as we saw with the Root Reset the Table initiative, the Rockefellers, they're also saying that they want to reset the food supply. They said that COVID has presented the opportunity to remake the entire food system and food supply. So all I see is that the same old people who've been messing with our world for the last 50, 60, maybe 100 years plus are here again trying to take advantage of a new crisis and tell us that they can be the ones to fix things. And I don't think any of us should trust that.
Well, I mean, it's all happening so fast. You've got all the leaders around the world, as in the, you know, President Biden, all of them standing up saying there is going to be a food shortage. It's coming. We've got cows, ridiculous amounts of cows, just all dropping dead. We've got, I live here in Texas, and I can tell you the farmers are suffering. They're sending their animals to slaughter. They are giving up their livelihoods because they can't cope anymore. The price of animal feed. You can see it all happening. So I'm going to ask you this question. What do you think the next 6 months is going to look like for us around the world? That's in America. You're not in America, but what are we facing if we allow this to continue? And it's continuing. I mean, it's,
yeah.
What are we looking at?
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason to suspect that these agendas are going to disappear over the next 6 months or a year. You know, one thing I like to remind people in my presentations and in my reports is that the World Economic Forum's The Great Reset agenda is very much tied to or based or just a rebranding of the Agenda 2030. So the year right now is 2022, and we're about halfway through this year already, and their agenda is 2030. So in the minds of these people, the next 8 years are going to be rapid transformation of everything we know, the way we interact with food, the way we interact with technology, the way we interact with government. This is what they have in mind. The Great Reset is nothing short of a complete transformation of our world, and not in a way that most people, I think, would anticipate that this kind of world that they want to live in, right? So I think it's a world that lacks privacy, a world that lacks liberty and bodily autonomy, clearly. So that's important, you know, whether we're talking 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, is that that's what this is about. This is all pushing towards Agenda 2030 and implementing this by the end of the decade. In fact, the United Nations and the World Economic Forum have called this the decade of transformation. So that's what we have to look forward in the bigger picture. Now, in the next immediate 6 months, I would say, especially because in the United States, there's an election coming up, and it's, you can sort of set your watch by it. And I ask anybody to use this and remember this too. Every summer before an election, there's going to be as many issues to argue and fight over, whether it's abortion, whether it's homelessness, whether it's a crime or this thing. It seems like all of a sudden the issues just make that are meant to divide people are front and center in the corporate mainstream media right before elections. So that's one thing that I would anticipate, is that there's going to be attempts to continue to divide people over the coming months leading to the midterms elections, as well as specifically to the food supply. I think we're going to continue to see attacks on the food supply. You know, we've seen the protests in the Dutch farmers, and we've seen farmers in Sri Lanka and elsewhere. So this is a worldwide issue that people's food systems are under attack, you know, and they're coming at it different ways, by trying to say that we need to reduce greenhouse emissions. We need to reduce the eating of meat, which, again, as a vegan, I don't eat meat. And you would think that those would be policies that I generally support. I mean, on one hand, okay, people eating less meat, I can kind of get behind that. But at the same time, knowing that there's a bigger picture here, that it is about promoting eating bugs and eating Bill Gates funded and financed Beyond burgers that are genetically engineered, that are 3D printed. This is not the kind of veganism. I wouldn't even call that veganism. I don't know what that is, but it's not something I support. So I expect, though, to see all those agendas continuing to ramp up. The stories are going to continue to tell you that because you're driving, things are getting bad. Because, you know, you're you're using fuel in whatever ways. I think we'll also see a continued push for the electric car industry. And again, electric cars, I don't have anything against that. But what we're seeing is the government is not coming out necessarily passing a law and saying, hey, you can't drive anymore. You can't eat meat anymore. But what they're going to do is try to tax it out of existence or to make it so difficult or so expensive that people will just say, you know what, I can't afford a burger anymore. I'll just eat this Bill Gates burger now. Or I can't afford to drive anymore, so I'll just drive Elon Musk's car that can be turned off remotely anytime, or that can be, you know, remotely driven wherever they want to take me. So I think that those same agendas are going to increase in the coming months. And I hope that, you know, we're talking about some really heavy stuff, and it's important to have these conversations because this is the reality. We shouldn't put our head in the sand. And yet also, I do want to take a moment to mention that there are, for all the work that they're doing and all the initiatives they're pushing, there are so many good things happening as well. So if I could take a moment, you know, the coming 6 months, I also see a lot of good things. I am part of the Freedom Cell Network, and just in the next couple of days, we're about to launch our new website, freedomcells.org, on August 1st. And one of the features we've added is the Agora Marketplace. And so people are going to have the opportunity to go on there and put your produce. If you're a backyard gardener, farmer, urban farmer, community farmer, or just big farm, whatever you got, this is going to give you another place where you can go on there to sell your goods and services, your honey, your veggies, your meat, whatever you got. This website allows you to come on there, create a profile, and then you can use our maps to search in your area to find people that are near you 5, 10, 15 miles. You can look up their profile, see what their skills are, their interests are. You can message them. The whole idea is to meet in person and to create these groups, or what we call cells and hubs, hives, circles, whatever name you want to get. The point is that right now it's more important than ever for us to come together and to connect with each other in this very real world way. We need the answer to all their system and the promotion of their ideas is localized food production. We need more growing in backyards, front yards, community gardens, urban gardens. We need more relationships with farmers. If you're not in a position where you can grow, then go meet the farmers near you who are doing things. Talk to them. Get a phone number. Get an email. Develop a relationship with them. Those relationships are going to be so important in the times we're facing. Use the Freedom Cells website. Connect with people. Start growing food. You know, start storing seeds. There are really so many things we actually can do in our lives to empower ourselves. And I think sometimes, you know, the conversation is so dark and heavy, and it needs to be. People need to kind of have a little bit of that realism. But don't forget, there are things we can also do. And I'll mention one more thing. One other resource is a website called saveourfood.net. And this one just launched in the last week and a half ago. My friend Henna Maria, she's a great activist. She's trying to bring together as many organizations. I know that they would love support of CHD to come together and say, look, we see that these problems, we see these food as a weapon of war and all this stuff. Why don't we collectively all focus on saving our food, and even just using that hashtag save our food, take a picture of yourself in the backyard garden, take a picture of yourself going to support somebody at a farmer's market, and spread that idea to show people that we really can do so much in our lives when it comes to this. They want us to believe that they're all powerful and that they've got the system and that you will own nothing and be happy, or you're going to eat the bugs. But for me, I refuse to accept that. I'm manifesting a different 2030 than what they're promoting. And I just want to invite everybody out there who does see some of those dark things in the next 6 months and beyond to really start thinking about, what does your 2030 look like, right? If you don't accept the Agenda 2030, if you don't accept the Great Reset, then what do you accept? What do you want for your friends, family, and your community? And that's where we need to be putting our energy in, I believe.
Oh, I love that. Great, great stuff. Okay, look, I want to just quickly talk about bugs and stuff. I mean, do vegans eat bugs? I don't know. Let's just play this quick clip, actually, so everybody can see what we're talking about. It's so weird. Check this out.
It's not normal that you try and create a high technology company that's farming millions of insects right in the heart of London. But insects are just nature's perfect upcycling machines that create organic, natural protein that we can feed to animals, eventually maybe humans.
They're small, creepy, and crawly. But could insects be key to feeding the world sustainably?
I'm Nicole Kidman, and I am going to eat a four-course meal of bugs.
So will farming and eating insects help solve one of the 21st century's biggest challenges?
These are grasshopper kebabs. Heartily encourage that you try one.
Okay.
I did it already.
That's my motto.
What's that, though? Yeah. So these are actual ants.
These are black ants from China.
We've created specialist chambers to look after the insects, their different life cycles. We can stack this 4 meters high and as many kilometers long as you like. We have automation systems that are modulated and run by themselves 24 hours a day, 365 days a year in any environmental condition. And that's vitally important to feeding a growing population.
Cornworms, they're still alive. Extraordinary. Very moist, chewy. Can't quite describe the flavor, but...
And most importantly, it's natural, it's normal, and it's the way that we have to feed the future.
2 billion people in the world eat bugs, and I'm one of them. Here we have... Oh! Crickets! Oh, nothing.
Oh! Oh!
Wow. You're muted again.
I'm muted again. I'm not doing a good job this morning. I don't think that's very sexy, wow. Nicole Kidman, sitting there in a dress doing this thing. Look.
I hadn't seen that.
Where are we going with this? Look, if you want to eat bugs, knock yourself out. Just don't replace what I want to eat with what you're telling me to eat. I mean, what's going on? It's control, right?
I think that's the big thing here, right? No, for me, the philosophy that I believe in is voluntarism. I believe that people should have the freedom to make their own choices and live the lifestyles they want, so long as they're not forcing you to do the same, right? Or saying, hey, I'm going to, you know, pass a law to make the government put you in jail if you don't respect my lifestyle or things like that, right? Like, live your life, don't harm anybody. I get that. So if you want to eat bugs, that's fine. Two things. There was actually one fact in that video towards the end, where it said that 2 billion, I don't know if the number is accurate, I think they said 2 billion, some number pretty large in the world of people do eat bugs right now. And that actually is accurate. So this is where I think sometimes the conversation, you know, it needs more nuance, not the black and white, right? The reality is that some people do eat bugs in the world, but those are people who either culturally have been eating bugs for generations or maybe out of necessity because of poverty bugs. Like, for example, in parts of Mexico, there are still some indigenous cultures that might go out and have been for however many years, thousands of years, as part of their meals, bugs get included in there or something like that, right? Not necessarily a whole culture built around eating bugs, but I just want to make that clear that there is some historical precedent for people getting their protein from bugs. But when you see a video like that, you see the talk show hosts and you see the actresses promoting it, and then we see the World Economic Forum promoting it, it's clear that there is an agenda that is being distilled down to the people. So these institutions talk about an idea, hey, maybe we all need to start eating bugs. They start writing papers about it. They start talking about it. They start putting videos about it. Somebody gives a call to a talk show host and says, hey, we're going to have a segment on celebrities eating bugs. You know, these sort of things. And they want you to believe, as that guy said, this is natural. It's normal. Maybe it is for some cultures and some people. But as you were saying, Polly, I don't think we should be forcing people for the supposed good of the environment or the climate to, you know, eat bugs. So again, even as a vegan, I would prefer if people became vegan by choice. If they decided, you know what, I don't think this meat works for me, health reasons, moral reasons, whatever, as opposed to the government coming and saying, hey, I'm going to force you to not eat meat, or I'm going to, you know, tax you up your farm or shut it down. I don't support or endorse any of those ideas. And other vegans might feel differently. But I do think that, yeah, it's important to know that that is an agenda that is absolutely being pushed. And so we need to separate that. They want to try to say it's normal because some people in the world do it. Well, those people are doing it by choice because of culture, different reasons. That's much different than an agenda that is trying to push this onto people and make it a cool trend of like eating bugs and restaurants trying to incorporate things like that. I think that there's got to be somebody in a boardroom laughing, watching Nicole Kidman eating that, you know, somebody who's like, oh my God, we actually got them to do it. And in mocking us is kind of what I feel like.
Well, there's no doubt in everyone's mind that food is being used as a weapon of war, a war on the people for control and compliance. What is your advice? Are you prepping? Do you advise people to prep? I mean, forget the food shortage, also the inflation. I mean, who can afford it? What is it going to be, triple the price by Christmas? Who knows? What is your advice to them to prepare for what is inevitable at the moment?
Well, step one, I would say, is to not get trapped in fear. Yeah, I think it is important to be prepared, right? Like, let's break the word prepping. It sometimes gets a bad rep. You know, people think of doomsday preppers, but really, what does that word mean? It means being prepared, right? And every single one of our ancestors, every single one of my, you know, our grandparents, I know my grandmother, she's grown up on a farm, lived on a farm her whole life. She's in her late 80s. If she hadn't prepared for the winter and baled the hay so the cows can eat, or, you know, canned the veggies and put them in the cellar, then they wouldn't make it and I wouldn't be here, right? So all of our cultures, all of our histories, all of our ancestry has prepped, has prepared. It's just a smart thing to do. But now we're kind of in a time and a place where we're being told that that's a crazy thing to do, to think ahead and think maybe we should plan for an emergency. Maybe we should make sure we have extra food in case food prices rise or in case we can't afford it because of inflation, right? So I do think it is important to try to approach this, you know, not in a state of panic and a state of fear. I moved to Mexico in March 2020. I'm from Texas as well, and I was planning on getting land in Texas, but I ended up just coming down here. It just ended up being a better situation for me. So I'm, you know, we're in the process, myself and a small group of people, we're in the process of getting land to start an intentional community. I'm permaculture certified. I encourage people to learn more about permaculture. It's just another way to approach growing food and interacting with animals and how you raise animals, how you grow your food, how you build your buildings. I encourage people to learn about permaculture, learn about, you know, food canning, food storage. And yes, if you have the resources to go put away a couple extra months of food for your family, then do that. And the other thing I would say is if your money is just sitting in the bank, you know, personally, I don't use banks. I haven't used banks since 2008. I don't want a relationship with them. I try to stay out of those systems. But even if you're not in that position, let's say you do have money in the bank. You mentioned inflation, Polly. Well, with the inflation, your money is slowly, you know, losing value. You're losing money just sitting in there. So even if you're not going to take the money out and go stuff it in your mattress, although I think that's a better use of it, even if you're not going to do that, you can maybe, you could invest in precious metals, you can invest in crypto, things like that, but invest in yourself. You know, if there's some courses you've been wanting to take, take the money out of the bank and put it in those courses and learn new skills. Because I also think the people who are going to survive and thrive into the coming challenges we're facing are going to be the people who are valuable, who have skills and things to offer. And those could be gardening skills, those could be tech skills, those could be just knowledge, all kinds of things. But now is the time to invest in yourself, to invest in your families. And if you're one of the people who are lucky enough to have extra resources, then I encourage you to do that. Take those resources, invest in that. Don't assume that when, you know, things get rough, that you're going to pull out your Patriot supply of seeds and all of a sudden know what to do. You know, maybe it's important to learn a little bit about those things beforehand. And, you know, having methods of self-defense and protection, I think that's valuable as well. But overall, just invest in yourself, invest in your family. I encourage people to check out the Freedom Cells website, get signed up as soon as we launch, check out Save Our Food. Of course, you know, stay informed through Children's Health Defense. There are so many things we can really practically do. And if prepping is one of them, then, and you have the resources, then I encourage you to do that. For sure.
And what's the Greater Reset? I love that name. So they've got the Table Reset or Food Reset, and you're the Greater Reset. What is that?
Yes. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to share about that. So again, if you're interested in solutions, the Greater Reset, thegreaterreset.org is a place that I encourage you to check out. So in 2020, when COVID was coming out, and then in June 2020, when the World Economic Forum announced the Great Reset, myself and some colleagues, we got together and we're like, okay, what are we going to do? You know, everybody's starting to obsess. Everybody was starting to learn about the Great Reset and hearing about it. And oh my God, we're kind of in a panic. And sure enough, in January 2021, the World Economic Forum was going to be meeting again. And so I started talking with some associates and said, so what are we going to do? Just sit there and watch them for a week and obsess about them and complain? And, you know, why don't we host our own event? And so we launched what we call the Greater Reset or the People's Reset, and we have the event at the exact same time as Davos meets and the World Economic Forum meets in Davos. So they get together for 5 days to talk about how they wish they could control the food supply and control the technology and control the education, everything from the top down. We get together for 5 days, bringing together brilliant minds, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has been on 2 times now, to talk about health, spiritual, mental, physical health, to talk about permaculture and growing food, to talk about decentralized technology, open source technology, how to get away from big tech, to talk about counter economics, how to get out of the banking system and how to create, you know, support, financial support for yourself outside of those systems, and then community building in general. So we've had 3 events now. Our next one is coming up January 2023, and this is a live event. Polly, you should go to the one in Texas. We have a live event in Texas and a live event in Mexico. I host the one in Mexico. My buddy hosts the one in Texas. Simultaneously live, we've got some speakers in each location, and it's for free to people to watch online. And if you go to thegreaterreset.org right now, you can click on the top where it says replays. And we have over 100 plus hours of content that you can watch. And this is all solutions for free. Not a single speaker is debating viruses, talking about the problems. It is all 100% solutions focused. So if you're a person that is really desperate right now to learn about solutions in some of these areas we talked about, I encourage you to go to the Greater Reset. And if you can make it in person, we would love to have you. We had 400 something people come to Mexico and 100 plus in Texas and in 10,000 live and 100,000 plus watch it afterwards. It's just been a great experience. And it's been showing people that there, again, there are things we can actually do in our lives, because they would like us to believe that they are all powerful. And rest assured, they do have a lot of power and they have a lot of influence and they are messing up our world. But we also have so much strength and so much power within each of us. It's just about, it's time for us to step up and come together and build the better world we know is possible, because we know that we can't count on them to do it.
Right, right. And what about the documentary? Did you say where we can watch that documentary that we introed in?
The pyramidofpower.net is the website. And so I've released, it's a 17-part documentary series that we've released 10 episodes so far. Actually, Chapter 11 on the banking cartel will be coming out on Monday. And we just release them every few weeks or every couple months. And the goal is, as I said, to try to identify all the pieces of this pyramid that works against us, the education system, the media, Hollywood, food, you know, all these different areas. And what I tried to do is to make the documentaries 25 to 30 minutes. So it's sort of like just a short TV show. You can convince your friend who doesn't want to usually listen, hey, just watch this show with me. And every single thing I show on there, every single thing I say is sourced, is documented. I have all the transcripts. People can read for themselves. They can check all the links. There's no conspiracy, no speculation. It's 100% fact, because the reality is that the truth is a little scarier than fiction, and we don't have to get into the speculation. The truth is already bad enough.
All right. Well, look, Derek Prose, you're doing amazing work, and thank you for all you're doing for us. And to the people listening, you know, if food is a weapon of war, then our weapon would be to grow our own food. We don't need them. Take control of ourselves. We are going to be okay, because we're going to take care of each other. So, Derek, please come back on again and update us and tell us when you've got new documentaries and things going on or any events. The people love you. They thank you for everything that you're doing for us. So thank you so much for coming on and telling us.
I appreciate you. Thank you guys so much. I will mention one last thing. My website, theconsciousresistance.com. I don't know if we mentioned that, but thank you, everybody. Appreciate you so much.
Wait a minute. Theconsciousresistance.com. Okay, got it up there. Anything else?
No, that's it. I know I have a lot of websites. Thank you, though.
You do. Well, have a wonderful weekend. And
thank you.
We will catch up with you again soon. Thank you for being on. And let's bring Riley in now. Riley, there she is.
Yes.
All right, I'll let you take over now. But that was fascinating too. And you know, everybody, we know, we can see what's going on out there with the food situation, but we're on it. All right, listen, I just want to say, Riley's going to talk to you about our film that we're premiering this afternoon. I watched it last night, Uninformed Consent. You've got to watch it. You've got to watch it. It's free. Riley's going to tell you when to watch it. It is long. And you can't like be doing something else. You have to watch it, because there's a lot of stuff that you're going to miss unless you literally are watching it. But it's really good. And it was a big reminder of what we've been through. Right. I'm going to be over and out. I'll see you guys on the roundtable this afternoon. It's going to be brilliant. A packed roundtable. Riley's going to take over now. I'm going to be quiet. And do you think Sage Vegan might love me now? What do you think?
I didn't see her. I'm going to have to send this to her email.
All right. Everyone out there, see you this afternoon, and over to Riley.
All right. Good morning, CHD family. Happy Friday. I don't know if anybody is hungry for breakfast after this episode. We might need to do some Mercola intermittent fasting, I think, after this one. But thank you so much to Derek Bros for joining us and coming on today. What a pleasure. Again, you can find more of Derek's work at freedomcells.org and also theconsciousresistance.com. Also, check out his incredible investigative journalism at thelastamericanvagabond.com. Anyway, it's time for the CHD TV weekly wrap-up. We have some exciting things going on for you today and this weekend. As Polly mentioned, starting soon at 12:30 p.m. ET, 9:30 a.m. PT, we will be premiering Uninformed Consent, an in-depth look into the COVID-19 narrative, who is controlling it, and how it's being used to inject an untested new technology into almost every person on the planet. The film in its two parts is 2 hours long, and it will be followed by a live Q&A with filmmakers and doctors featured in the movie, Todd Harris, Dr. Stephen Malthouse, Alan Castles, Dr. Christopher Shaw, and Ted Koontz. So you don't want to miss this world premiere. Stick with us. And then tomorrow, we have a very exciting and inspiring event because tomorrow marks the official launch of our CHD Africa chapter. Yes, we will be hosting a live event to kick off the chapter's opening, hosted by Executive Director Shabnam Palesa Mohammed. The event will feature a film screening of Medical Racism, The New Apartheid, and speakers include Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Mary Holland, Dr. Sakiwo Yako, Dr. Evie Rapidi, who I like to call the African Pierre Corey, Dr. Eva Mugisa, Nanda Subin, Curtis Cost, and many more. So definitely tune in, watch live right here at CHDTV tomorrow. That's starting at 12 p.m. ET, 9 a.m. PT. It's going to be a truly historic event as the world turns together in solidarity with Africa against the WHO power grab, the people of sovereign nations standing together. So yes, this is big, bad news for the dark side. And it's so exciting because the support of the African people who have long shared our mission is vital in taking down these oppressive biomedical institutions. And as Shabnam always says, the power of the people is greater than the people in power. So we look forward to seeing you there. But first, stay tuned for the world premiere of Uninformed Consent today. And stay with us after the weekend, because on Monday, on Tea Time, Vera Sharav, human rights defender and Holocaust survivor, joins us with Scott Shara to deliver a very important message. So from all of us at CHDTV, we love you. Stick with us, and we'll see you back here soon.
The safest thing for your child, 12 and older, is to get them vaccinated.
16 to 24-year-olds who receive the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine have experienced higher than normal cases of myocarditis and inflammation of the heart muscle.
The one truth you won't be told is an 85-year-old has a 10,000 times greater chance of dying than the 10-year-old. Do you think a 10-year-old should get the same health care and the same prescriptions for what they need to do as an 85-year-old?
You're going to be able to get your vaccine as soon as you turn 5. And I know you're excited and I know you're eager.
I got the second COVID shot Tuesday, and within 4 days, I have been diagnosed with myocarditis.
Every single vaccine available in Canada has been approved by Health Canada as being both safe and effective. We all want to get through this pandemic as quickly as possible, and that means all of us getting vaccinated.
They carry on forcing people to have this shot that has now broken all records for vaccine injury and death, and is clearly not working. None of this makes sense.
Divide and conquer has been in the playbook for such a long time, and we're seeing that now. So what they did in the Nazis is they picked out the Jews, and then they created a health issue so people would have an excuse and something to direct their anger at, the Jews as being unclean and infectious. So that helped people justify their actions. We're doing the same thing now. They're creating the dangerous, infectious people who have not had the COVID-19 vaccine, that those people are a danger to the other. And that's how it's created this division of the vaxxed versus the unvaxxed.
Careful science is slow. It takes a while.
When you get dug into these positions and you can't come out of those foxholes, you can't be flexible, then we're stuck with bad policy.